Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering for you today, Monday, October 7th, 2019. The British ambassador to South Sudan says it's time the parties to the peace deal resolve their remaining issues.
I have to say that I think we are a little bit disappointed that more progress has not been made.
And a new Amnesty International report says impunity for criminals is the norm in South Sudan.
The justice system lacks independence, and we documented many cases that point to that. First of all, being undue interference with the judiciary from the executive.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The new British ambassador to South Sudan, Chris Trott, says the parties that signed the revitalized peace deal last year should create a unified army and resolve the stalemate over the number of states before forming a transitional government by the November 12th deadline. Trott says he'll remind the parties about the commitments they made and says he's concerned about the slow progress in carrying out security arrangements.
Having spent 3 years working on the peace process and trying to support the IGAD mediation and support the parties to the conflict to come together and work together for the future of this country, it feels totally appropriate for me to have moved from that job into a job that brings me here to Juba to support the implementation of the peace process. So that's probably my top priority, is supporting the peace process. But also, the difference between my last job and my current job is that I'm focused much more broadly on the range of British support to South Sudan. So I'm now looking at issues around education, around health, around Ebola, around even the humanitarian support that we're providing, so that I understand the depth and the breadth of the British engagement here in South Sudan.
You have been interacting with some of the main actors in South Sudan when you were the special envoy for Sudan and South Sudan. What is your assessment of the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement since the parties requested for an extension in May?
I have to say that I think we are a little bit disappointed that more progress has not been made. While we recognize that absolutely a significant amount of progress has been achieved since perhaps the signing of the agreement on the 12th of September last year, our concerns are that in spite of the extension, we have still not yet seen the creation of a national unified army, even a small number of troops, although yesterday I was pleased to see the graduation of some of the trainers who are going to be responsible for creating that force. And we're still waiting for a discussion to take place around the number of states during the transition period. But I think more important than the sort of implementation of those details, what I think we would like to see more of is we'd like to see more engagement, not just between Riek Machar and President Kiir, although that's very important to, I think, demonstrating that this peace is going to last, but also more engagement between the two of them and the wider leadership of the future transitional government of national unity in advance of the 12th of November.
And in the backdrop of this situation where the two parties to the agreement are lagging behind in the formation of a unified army for the country as stipulated in the peace agreement, what potential red flags are there?
Well, the most important thing, I think, is to avoid creating a situation that led to a resumption of conflict in 2016. So I think it's not for me to judge what the minimum sort of requirements are in order to ensure that that doesn't happen. But I think that we would expect the parties through a dialogue to come to an agreement amongst themselves as to how much of what was anticipated in the peace agreement is actually delivered on in advance of the 12th of November, and what could be perhaps left to be completed beyond the 12th of November when we have our new transitional government in place.
Some analysts in the East Africa region have been saying that peace is elusive in South Sudan. Given that scenario, what are your expectations once the transitional government of national unity is formed to lead the country into elections? What are your expectations?
I would challenge the word elusive. I think the peace is fragile. But I think that what the AAS, the revitalized agreement, does is it creates an opportunity for the parties to the conflict and their international friends and partners to work together over the period of the transition to implement the rest of the agreement, not just chapters 1 and 2, which has been the focus of the last 3 months, but the rest of the agreement, so that we can then put the economy on a more solid footing. We can ensure that people start to see accountability and justice. We see greater transparency in the way that this country is being governed and the way that its resources are being utilized. And I think those sorts of things over the 3-year transition would create a significant momentum that would then deliver a more sustainable peace for South Sudan, a peace for which the people are desperately crying out.
That's in British Ambassador to South Sudan, Chris Trott, and he was speaking from Juba with my colleague John Tanza over the weekend. Tomorrow, Trott talks about recent conversations he's had with South Sudanese across the country. A new Amnesty International report on South Sudan says impunity has flourished in the face of serious human rights violations, war crimes, and crimes against humanity for years in the country. The rights group is urging the African Union to establish an ad hoc tribunal for South Sudan if the government fails to establish the hybrid court as spelled out in the peace deal. Winnie Serino has more for VOA from Juba.
Save Magango, Deputy Director for Amnesty International, says a research team found that South Sudan's justice system is biased. Speaking by phone from Nairobi, he says there have been crimes ranging from deliberate killings of civilians to rape and other forms of violence against South Sudanese, which have never been addressed.
The justice system lacks independence, and we documented many cases that point to that, first of all being undue interference with the judiciary from the executive. The judges are appointed by the president, and they cannot proceed to prosecute or investigate cases until they receive instruction from the executive. And this is particularly to do with the prosecutor's office, which fails to investigate.
Magango says if the prosecutors are not given directives, then serious crimes are not investigated. He says from Juba to Malakal, Wau and Bentiu, a trail of monstrous crimes against civilians were committed, and the South Sudan government responded with investigative committees whose report rarely see the light of day, or their findings are largely ignored.
If any investigation is carried out, no report is published, so and no action is taken. So it seems like a case of window dressing when the government calls an investigation or directs that an investigation be undertaken.
Magango says the people of South Sudan deserve justice. The report states that the only prosecution for a crime committed in South Sudan was a little over a year ago in September, when a military court convicted 10 government soldiers of killing a journalist and raping aid workers at the Terrain Hotel complex in July 2016. He says the trial largely happened because of pressure from foreign governments seeking justice for their citizens. Magango says military courts lack jurisdiction to try cases of crimes against civilians under South Sudanese law. He says the case should have been tried by civilian courts to be consistent with international practice. He says many victims had placed their hopes for justice in the hybrid court that was supposed to be created in South Sudan but has yet to be established. He says the African Union should step in.
You've seen people who have been who are accused and actually have been named by the UN Security Council as suspects in the perpetration of these crimes against humanity and human rights violations. Some of them have been promoted. So really, it is a catalogue of problems with regard to this situation. But the bottom line is we'd like them to make moves and start making progress towards forming the hybrid court. And if they don't, we are calling on the African Union to take it within its own hands and set up an ad hoc tribunal.
Begango says all too often the president has granted blanket amnesties, a violation of international law which denies victims their rights to truth, justice and reparations. Saturday in Focus contacted Justice Minister Paulino Wanawila, who declined to comment on the report, saying, quote, "Even the justice of the Voice of America has been very corrupt. It is an allegation, and I don't talk about silly things, allegations like that which is baseless." He then hung up the phone. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
South Sudan's petroleum minister says an oil spill from a broken pipeline some 2 weeks ago owned by an oil consortium which polluted several parts of former Unity State has been contained. But the minister warns that more oil pipelines may rupture as Juba makes plans to boost oil production in the country. Lusuba Memo has this report for VOA from Juba.
Speaking publicly for the first time since the oil pipeline broke 2 weeks ago, South Sudan Petroleum Minister Awoh Daniel Chuang said today in Juba that the oil spill 15 kilometers north of Laluba in northern Leech State was contained after Greater Pioneer Operating Company, or GPOC, dispatched foreign experts to the area last week.
A rush repair team from the company, GPOC, went to the site and then they contained the leakage because the pipeline, of course, has been constructed a long time ago and it is aging. And as it ages, of course, weak points will always develop as the pipeline continues to age.
Greater Pioneer Operating Company is an oil consortium operating in South Sudan, owned by China's National Petroleum Corporation, Malaysia's Petronas, India's ONGC, Videsh, and South Sudan's Nile Petroleum Corporation. Chuang says as much as 2,000 barrels of oil could have leaked into the surrounding land and water since the pipeline burst on September 25th. When asked about the oil spill's impact on the local population, Chuang said the leakage took place in a remote area where there is no human settlement. Speaking in Arabic, Budang County Commissioner Gatieb Both Gabriel disputes that claim, saying the surrounding area has been damaged.
The leakage has stopped, but the impact is so big. It is drying trees, killing cattle, and it is poisoning people, and the water is flowing into the Nile.
Gabriel fears people living along the Nile, especially villagers near the area where the pipe broke, may be drinking contaminated water. When asked what the minister is doing, Awoh says plans are underway to retrieve the leak oil with powerful vacuums on trucks.
The oil and the water will always be sucked by vacuum trucks so that it is retrieved and taken back to the system because it can always be treated. Because when you mix water and oil, you can always take it back to the system in the FEF where it can also be recycled back to the system. And then the soil is treated to a level where it can be environmentally friendly.
Chuang insists the spill covers only about 400 square meters, but Gabriel believes the affected area is much larger than that. Chuang warns other pipelines may burst in the area in the near future because of corrosion and no maintenance. He points out some pipelines have not been in use since late 2013 when the fighting in the area forced officials and company executive to halt oil production.
So critical for us to make sure that this time around, as long as we have started to resume oil in block 1214, the pipeline is not new, then we should always expect this kind of leakage from time to time. But these are normal, controllable, And of course, what is important is for you to respond to those leakages from time to time.
Chuang says that his ministry is working to contract a foreign company to carry out an environmental audit. Last week, a child was born with a deformity in northern Leech State whose photograph was shared widely on social media. That prompted public debate on the effects oil pollution on people living in the area. Chuang says the child has been taken to Nairobi, Kenya for further medical examination. For VOA News, I am Lasuba Memo in Juba.
You're tuned to South Sudan In Focus from the Voice of America. A South Sudanese student is killed in India. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the best advice you would give to a child?
The best advice I can give to a child, more especially here in Africa, is that we need to work hard in class and we need to be focused on our future, what we can be after finishing our education.
Best advice I would give is to follow each and everything that the guardian advises him or her.
I think to be disciplined and try to work as hard as possible in his education and even be very practical, actually, because what we are living in today, people will get very a long way forward when they are very practical.
Working hard, being persistent, yes. Because the way Uganda is at this point, we have to work hard. We have to be so persistent on what we like.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
South Sudan In Focus is now on WhatsApp. Send us a message on +1 202 630 8011. Tell us what's happening in your area or give us your feedback on the stories you hear on South Sudan In Focus. We look forward to hearing from you on WhatsApp. That number again, +1 202 630 8011.
You're listening to South Sudan In Focus from the Voice of America. South Sudan is urging the government of India to investigate the recent killing of a young South Sudanese who was studying pharmacology in Bangalore, India. The Indian ambassador to South Sudan insists his government is investigating the incident and will bring the perpetrators to justice. Viola Elias has the story for VOA from Juba.
Montoj Munyir was stabbed to death in Bangalore 4 days ago. Foreign Affairs Deputy Minister Deng Dao Deng calls his death a great loss to the entire country. Deng says South Sudan has asked India to provide more information about Montoj's mother.
We officially request from the government of India to give us the detailed report of what happened to this particular student. We have also requested for the transport of the remains of this particular student.
Speaking to South Sudan In Focus by phone from India, Angok Atiang, chairman of South Sudanese Student Association in India, says Munyir was admitted to Bangalore University in 2013. Adiang says eyewitnesses informed him that the 29-year-old student was attacked at night while walking alone on the streets of Bangalore.
People who were in the city later got the information at a late hour that there is one South Sudanese who got stabbed with a knife by unknown people and he is now in the hospital. So when people went there, they found him already taken to the operation room.
Adiang says Montoj was unable to speak to anyone. He says the South Sudanese students in India have so far heard nothing about an investigation into their friend's death.
Actually, we are still looking for full details about the death of Montoj. Until now, investigation has not taken place as it has been all these days.
Indian ambassador to South Sudan, Subramoyan Dukia Morte, insists his government is investigating the mother but declined to comment further. Deng says South Sudan Ministry of Foreign Affairs has a duty to monitor the welfare of all South Sudanese citizens residing abroad.
We should work 24 hours so that all the information related to our country, all the citizens of South Sudan abroad, any citizen, students, or even citizens that are staying, residing by any reason, they should be known by our embassies, including those who are arrested and those who are in prisons. We should know them.
The father to the late Munyir described his son as a quiet and humble child. Speaking in Arabic, Munyir Deng says he was happy to learn his son receive a scholarship to study in India and had a high expectation for him.
It is so painful, not just to me as a father, but he is a student who went to study and learn for the future of South Sudan and the future of the people of South Sudan. The information for me is so painful. Death is not the problem, because everyone will die because God has created life and death together. but the problem is the nature of how the incident happened in a foreign land.
Deng says the government must pay close attention to all South Sudanese studying abroad and is calling on South Sudan and India government to investigate the death of his son and bring the culprit to justice. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
We turn to Kenya now, where the Sengwer, an indigenous hunter-gatherer community in the western part of the country, presented a petition today to the national government demanding the return and protection of what they call their ancestral lands. The community says it faces threats of eviction as the government takes over conservation of Kenya's forests and water supplies. Rael Ambour reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Hundreds of members of the Sengwer, a community that lives in the Embobut Forest, spent 2 days marching from the ancestral land in Kenya's North Rift Valley to Nairobi in hopes of meeting President Uhuru Kenyatta. Dressed in traditional regalia, they sang traditional songs as they arrived in Nairobi with a petition to the government. 85-year-old Moses Leleu took part in the march.
Sisi kama jamii atujatambulewa.
Leleu says, as a community, we are yet to be recognized as a Kenyan tribe. That's one of the main reasons we are here. The second is that we have been evicted several times from our ancestral land. We are now living in a small portion in these lands and still face imminent eviction. We want to go back to the areas we have been evicted from and be recognized as the owners of our ancestral land. Hunter-gatherer communities in Kenya are facing threat of eviction as the government takes over management of the country's forests and water catchment areas. Embobut Forest is listed as one of the 5 most important water catchment areas in Kenya. Since the 1970s, Kenya's government, through its forest service guards, has carried out a series of forceful evictions of the Sengwer in Embobut. An Amnesty International report said that during evictions in 2017, forces burnt more than 300 houses, injured hundreds, and killed a Sengwer man. Amnesty International's director in Kenya, Irungu Houghton, worked with the Sengwer in Nairobi Monday.
Their community is not considered by economists to be a big economic, have economic value to this country, nor are they considered to be politically very, very powerful. But they are Kenyans and they deserve their rights like any other Kenyan. But in addition, they are indigenous people, which means that they have a responsibility to the earth that is very different from the rest of us. Their land is ancestral. They have for centuries been responsible for taking care of the forests of places like Embobut in Elgeyo Marakwet.
Speaking to VOA, a senior Kenya Forest Service official said Embobut Forest was a government-gazetted forest and not an ancestral land. The official said the Sengwer were not a tribe, but a clan within another community that is not laying claim to the forest. The Embobut Forest is not the only area witnessing disputes between indigenous people and the government. In August, the government announced plans to evict thousands they considered encroachers in sections of Kenya's Mau Forest, arguing that the move was to save the Mau ecosystem, which is threatened by heavy deforestation and encroachment. In a report last month, Human Rights Watch asked the government to stop the excessive use of force during the Mau evictions and uphold proper guidelines in the ongoing process. Kenya's Minister of Environment and Forestry set up a task force late last year to advise the government on how to resolve disputes regarding indigenous people's claims to forest lands that are critical to Kenya's conservation efforts. The task force is set to present its findings to the ministry this month. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Rwandan government says it has tracked down and killed 19 assailants and captured 5 others who carried out an attack that left 14 people dead and another 18 injured in an area adjacent to the Virunga National Park, home of the mountain gorillas. The surviving attackers admitted fighting for FDLR, an anti-Rwandan government terror group operating in the neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo. They say they were the first wave in an attempt to overthrow the government in Kigali. The government has mounted additional patrols in the area and say the rebels cannot succeed. Eugene Uimana has the details.
The five captured alleged attackers say they joined the FDLR in Uganda, but that they did not initially intend to destabilize the Rwandan government. One of them is Theoneste Habumukiza, a business administration graduate from the University of Rwanda. He says he was recruited while pursuing a master's degree at Uganda's Makerere University in the capital, Kampala. He says he was approached by a wealthy person who encouraged him to join the FDLR, saying that when they capture the country, they would reward him with a well-paying job and other incentives. Arriving in DRC, I found myself in the terror group, he says. But arriving in the eastern DRC, they were convinced to fight to overthrow the Rwandan government. The captured assailants came in the first group of 45 and attacked with 38 guns and traditional weapons. Another 400 rebels stayed behind, ready to strike too. The survivors described the terrifying attack Friday night. He says it was around 8 p.m. and we heard people coming from the Virunga National Park shooting, killing people. Arriving here in the center, they used knives and hoes to kill whoever wakes up and sees them, he says. All of the victims were buried yesterday. In the houses of survivors, fear still reigns. He says they are not sleeping. They are fearing that assailants can come back again without being seen, as they did on a Friday. Rwanda National Police say so far 19 assailants were killed and all attackers have been neutralized. CP John Bosco Cabrera, the police spokesperson, says residents should feel relief at the quick response by security forces. We are commending the community policing spirit of the residents. With them, we have been able to know where the assailants are hiding. Some were even caught by the local civilians. Security forces have intervened on time. Everything is okay now. Hearts of Rwandans need to be relieved. Assailants can't defeat us. The government says all activities are back to normal in the area of the attack. The attack comes as a military court in Kigali began hearing last week the case of 25 alleged members of the Rwanda National Congress, a dissident political party led by former Rwanda Chief Defence Staff General Kayumba Nyamwasa, who is in exile in South Africa. Eugene Wimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
And that's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Tong Tong by the artist Sweet J from Yambio. We've been listening to Sweet Jay from Yambio with the song Tong Tong. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington. We're glad you could be here with us today. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Like it's a gun, it's a bug, you know.